Okay, so here we go with 1 Samuel chapters 27, 28, and 29. David said in his heart, I shall now perish one day by the hand of Saul. There is nothing better for me than to escape to the land of the Philistines. Then Saul will despair of seeking me any longer within the borders of Israel, and I shall escape out of his hand. So David set out and went over, he and the 600 men who were with him, to King Achish of Maok, son of Maok of Gath. David stayed with Achish at Gath, and he and his troops, and every man with his household, and David with his two wives, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail of Carmel, Nabal's widow. When Saul was told that David had fled to Gath, he no longer sought for him. Then David said to Achish, If I have found favor in your sight, let a place be given me in one of the country towns so that I may live there. For why should your servant live in the royal city with you? So that day Achish gave him Ziklag. Therefore Ziklag has belonged to the kings of Judah to this day. The length of time that David lived in the country of the Philistines was 1 year and 4 months. Now David and his men went up and made raid on the Geshurites, the Gerzites, and the Amalekites, for these were the landed settlements from Telam on the way to Shur and on the land of Egypt. David struck the land, leaving neither man nor woman alive, but took away the sheep, the oxen, the donkeys, the camels, and the clothing, and came back to Achish. When Achish asked, Against whom have you made a raid today? David would say, Against the Negev of Judah, or against the Negev of the Jerahmeelites, or against the Negev of the Kenites. David left neither man nor woman alive to be brought back to Gath, thinking, They might tell about us, and say, David has done so and so. Such was his practice all the time he lived in the country of the Philistines. Achish trusted David, thinking, He has made himself utterly abhorrent to his people Israel, therefore he shall always be my servant. In those days the Philistines gathered their forces for war to fight against Israel. Achish said to David, You know, of course, that you and your men are to go out with me in the army. David said to Achish, Very well, then you shall know what your servant can do. Achish said to David, Very well, I will make you my bodyguard for life. Now Samuel had died, and all Israel had mourned for him and buried him in Ramah, his own city. Saul had expelled the mediums and the wizards from the land. Philistines assembled and came and encamped at Shunem. Saul gathered all Israel, and they encamped at Gilboa. When Saul saw the army of the Philistines, he was afraid, and his heart trembled greatly. When Saul inquired of the Lord did not answer him, not by dreams, or by Urim, or by prophets. Then Saul said to his servant, Seek out for me a woman who is a medium, so that I may go to her and inquire of her. His servant said to him, There is a medium at Endor. So Saul disguised himself and put on other clothes and went there, he and two men with him. They came to the woman by night, and he said, Consult a spirit for me and bring up for me the one whom I name to you. The woman said to him, Surely you know what Saul has done, how he has cut off the mediums and the wizards from the land. Why then are you laying a snare for my life to bring about my death? But Saul swore to her by the Lord, As the Lord lives, no punishment shall come upon you for this thing. Then the woman said, Whom shall I bring up for you? He answered, Bring up Samuel for me. When the woman saw Samuel, she cried out with a loud voice, and the woman said to Saul, Why have you deceived me? You are Saul. The king said to her, Have no fear. What do you see? The woman said to Saul, I see a divine being coming out of the ground. He said to her, What is his appearance? She said, An old man is coming up. He is wrapped in a robe. So Saul knew that it was Samuel, and he bowed with his face to the ground and did obeisance. Then Samuel said to Saul, Why have you disturbed me by bringing me up? Saul answered, I am in great distress, for the Philistines are warring against me, and God has turned away from me and answers me no more, either by prophets or by dreams. So I have summoned you to tell me what I should do. Samuel said, Why then do you ask me, since the Lord has turned from you and become your enemy? The Lord has done to you just as he spoke by me, for the Lord has torn the kingdom out of your hand and given it to your neighbor David, because you did not obey the voice of the Lord and did not carry out his fierce wrath against Amalek. Therefore the Lord has done this thing to you today. Moreover, the Lord will give Israel along with you into the hands of the Philistines, and tomorrow you and your sons shall be with me. The Lord will also give the army of Israel into the hands of the Philistines. Immediately Saul fell full length on the ground, filled with fear because of the words of Samuel. and there was no strength in him, for he had eaten nothing all day and all night. The woman came to Saul, and when she saw that he was terrified, she said to him, "Your servant has listened to you. I have taken my life in your hand and have listened to what you have said to me. Now, therefore, you also listen to your servant. Let me set a morsel of bread before you. Eat, that you may have strength when you go on your way." He refused and said, "I will not eat." But his servants, together with the woman, urged him, and he listened to their words. So he got up from the ground and sat on the bed. Now the woman had a fatted calf in the house. She quickly slaughtered it, and she took flour, kneaded it, and baked unleavened cakes. She put them before Saul and his servants, and they ate. Then they rose and went away that night. Now the Philistines gathered all their forces at Aphek, while the Israelites were encamped by the fountain that is in Jezreel. As the lords of the Philistines were passing on by hundreds and by thousands, and David and his men were passing on in the rear with Achish, the commanders of the Philistines said, "What are these Hebrews doing here?" Achish said to the commanders of the Philistines, "Is this not David, the servant of King Saul of Israel, who has been with me now for days and years? Since he has deserted to me, I have found no fault in him to this day." But the commanders of the Philistines were angry with him, and the commanders of the Philistines said to him, "Send the man back, so that he may return to the place that you have assigned to him. He shall not go down with us to battle, or else he may become an adversary to us in the battle. For how could this fellow reconcile himself to his Lord? Would it not be with the heads of the men here? Is this not David, of whom they sing to one another in dances? Saul has killed his thousands, and David his 10,000s. Then Achish called David and said to him, "As the Lord lives, you have been honest, and it seems to me right that you should march out and in with me in the campaign, for I have found nothing wrong in you from the day of your coming to me until today. Nevertheless, the Lord's do not approve of you. So go back now and go peaceably. Do nothing to displease the lords of the Philistines." David said to Achish, "But what have I done? What have you found in your servant from the day I entered your service until now, that I should not go and fight against the enemies of my lord the king?" Achish replied to David, "I know that you are blameless in my sight as an angel of God. Nevertheless, the commanders of the Philistines have said, 'He shall not go up with us to the battle.' Now then, rise early in the morning, you and the servants of your lord who came with you, and go to the place that I appointed for you. As for the evil report, do not take it to heart, for you have done well before me. Start early in the morning and leave as soon as you have light." So David set out with his men early in the morning to return to the land of the Philistines. But the Philistines went up to Jezreel.
The word of the Lord.
Thank you,
Matt. Yes. May you write back and see a glass of water for my throat. Is this actually coffee? Oh, that's cold. Okay. I'll be right back. So, David realizes that no matter what he does and no matter what Saul says, that Saul is not going to stop chasing him. And so he decides that he's basically going to migrate to Philistia because he's fairly confident that Saul won't try to chase him down there because that would spark a war. And he's followed by his men. And of all the places in Philistine where he would go, he chose Gath, Goliath's hometown. He presents himself to the king says, "Why don't you give me a place of my own?" This was a not uncommon practice for a warrior of significance or a commander of men. I mean, they would be given sort of a semi-feudal tract of land. So he got Ziklag, which apparently remained in the possession of Judah for as long as it survived. And he was there for 16 months. And this, you know, has a tint of scandal to it for David, who would become king, the chosen of Yahweh, to consort with the chronic foe of Israel. We're going to see near the end of the chapters we read today that they're cleaning that up a little bit. Because there is just a little tint of scandal. But this also demonstrates how clever David is and how no matter what circumstances may be, Yahweh's will be done. So he and his men, they make some raids on the Geshurites, the Girzites, and the Amalekites. And these are people whose lands bordered roughly on Philistia toward the southwest in the direction of Egypt. And so these would have been natural allies. And of course, as we already know, in chapter 15, Yahweh ordered Saul to wage a holy war against the Amalekites. And so in a way, David is continuing along this path. And he's very vicious in what he does. He kills every inhabitant, but he does take away the flocks and the herds and the clothing. You got to get those bolts of cloth. And it's interesting because this is in contrast, you know, in chapter 15, if you go back, and we're going to hear about this when Samuel sort of is summoned by the medium. What really was the beginning of the end for Saul was when God said, go wipe out the Amalekites. And he showed mercy to the king, he didn't kill him, and he allowed his troops to plunder. And God didn't want any of that. David, different rules seem to apply to him here. Because he can slay the Amalekites and have no negative consequences. And you could take it a couple of different ways. One, you could say you're comparing apples to oranges, because David, there's no indication here that he's doing this in obedience to a command from God. He's just running around killing and plundering people. You know, whereas Saul, you know, violated a direct order from God. But I don't think that this detail is coincidental. It's too convenient for that. I think that this builds on a message that has been crescendoing over the past several chapters, that David has been chosen by Saul in such a way that the same rules just don't apply to David as apply to Saul. He kills everybody because he doesn't want Achish to actually know what's going on, because when he comes back and the king says, hey, how was it today? And he's like, oh yeah, I went down to those guys in the Negev of the Jeremelites and the Kenites and the Negev of Judah. And these were all Judites, or they were allies who had territory bordering on Judah. So what David was telling the king was, is, yeah, I've been killing and plundering my own people and their allies, when in fact he had been killing and plundering the king's allies. So he was working subversively while being hosted and sponsored by this king. And he falls for it. You know, the final verse of chapter 27, Achish says, he has made himself utterly abhorrent to his people Israel, therefore he shall always be my servant. And, you know, the lesson that we receive from this, it's always very important to do your research. You know, you could, in essence, view David in this situation as a propagator of fake news funded by Russia. And so you should always, you know, check your sources when you see something on the line, because Achish in the end is going to pay horribly for his naivete and his unwarranted trust in David. Now, everything was going well and good until the Philistines decided to gear up for war against Israel again. And of course, Achish's expectation was that, you know, David's burned all of his bridges. He's been pretty loyal to me. I mean, I'm sure the king got a cut of whatever, you know, David brought home from these raids. So, hey, fall in line. David says, okay, yeah, sure, that'd be great. And the king makes him his bodyguard. You know, so that's big stuff. And this puts David in a pretty serious bind, though, because to fight against his own people would have been a betrayal. He would have been seen as a traitor, and it would have delegitimized any claim that he had to be king after Saul. But unfortunately, we're going to have to wait in suspense to see how that situation resolves itself, because very abruptly, in the third verse of chapter 28, we go from the Philistine camp to Saul's camp. And it begins with just a brief reminder that Samuel died and they buried him at Ramah. And after that, Saul had exiled all the mediums and the wizards. There are lots of different ways to try to determine the will of God, and there are three basically accepted ways. You had to be a bona fide prophet, and there were certain characteristics, which we've seen demonstrated throughout 1 Samuel. You could have dreams. You could receive dreams from God, or you could consult the Urim and the Thummim to get a yes-no answer from one of those stones, or both of them. But other methods were considered unacceptable. And you can read about the prohibition of practicing sorcery. This is in your notes, but for the folks who may be listening online, Deuteronomy chapter 18, verse 9 through 22. You got Leviticus chapter 19, verse 31, and then chapter 20, verse 6. I mean, you could be put to death for this, all right? And so, in a way, I guess he's kind of been lenient on them because they're still alive to be exiled. So he throws them out. And Saul sees the Philistines coming. He pulls his army together. And he's just absolutely terrified. He doesn't have David with him. You know, by now, you know, he's become increasingly weak. And so I imagine that he found himself at a great disadvantage. And plus, the man was just pretty much out of his skull. So even if he was on even odds, he was probably scared out of his pants. So he asks God, and God doesn't give him any answer. And in desperation, he gets his servants to seek out the exact sort of person that he had thrown out of the country, trying to obey God's law. So, you know, poor man. You know, he tries to do the right thing. He does the right thing. And then immediately he goes back and he does something twice as bad by actually going to consult one himself. But he doesn't appear to have any alternatives. They said, well, so there's a medium at Endor, the legendary witch of Endor, she's usually known. So Saul puts on some glasses and a beard, cuts his hair different. At night he goes with two men and says, hey, yeah, I want you to have a little seance for me. For somebody in particular. And the woman's suspicious, understandably, and she says, you know, the king, you know, has forbidden me from doing this, and so what you're asking me to do is jeopardize my life. And this is where the narrative gets a little confusing over the next four verses. Saul says, nothing's going to happen to you, don't worry. And then she says, well, who do you want? And he says, Samuel. And then she sees Samuel. And then she says to Saul, why did you lie to me? And he says, you know, you're Saul himself. And the king said, well, don't worry about it. Just tell me what you see. And then in very vague terms, she says, I see a divine being coming out of the ground. Saul's like, what does he look like? Well, he's old. He's got a robe around him. And somehow Saul knew it was Samuel. So from the beginning, she knows she's seeing Samuel, right? But she never actually names him when Saul asks, who are you seeing? She gives him this kind of vague description. Why wouldn't she just say, it's Samuel, dummy? Why is it that when she saw Samuel, she suddenly realized that, you know, her customer was Saul? And this is where we again see this sort of overlapping of traditions in a sometimes messy way. For the most part, it's beautifully done without too much of a hiccup, but this can be a slightly confusing thing. You know, it could be that she raised Samuel and realized that the only person who would, you know, want to talk to Samuel that badly would probably be Saul, because there were also penalties for consulting a medium, not just for practicing it. And some people say, oh no, the assurance that Saul gave was only the assurance that could be given by a king. And so it was that assurance that indicated to her that he was the king, but there was a lapse between his assurance and him naming whom he wanted brought up and her bringing Samuel up. So in this little piece of the story, we really don't know what's going on. What we do know is going on is that Saul was desperate. He wanted to talk to Samuel. He went to the last person that he should have done to be a faithful king to do so. This woman was reluctant for good reason. She summoned Samuel. He came. She got scared because somehow she realized it was Saul. Okay? And then in verse 15, Samuel always a little on the grumpy side, as prophets tend to be. He's sort of like, I set my alarm clock for the second coming. What are you doing? And actually, they were still waiting for the first coming. So let's be accurate. And Saul's like, man, I'm in trouble. The Philistines are coming, and God won't talk to me. And so I thought maybe you could tell me what to do. And Samuel's like, why are you asking me? If God hasn't answered you through any of the others' means, why would He answer you through me of all people? Because I've already proclaimed God's intentions towards you. You're enemies now, and He's doing exactly what He said He would do through me. He's going to transfer the kingship from you to David because, going back to chapter 15, you didn't do what God told you to do. You let King Amalek live. You let the livestock live to enrich yourself. And so you're going to get beaten. And this time tomorrow, you and your sons are going to be with me. In other words, dead. And so Saul just collapses, and he's not eating all day. He was probably fasting, but so yeah, he collapses, low blood sugar level, and a woman comes, and this is just pitiful, okay? This little thing here, because this is a woman who's afraid she's going to die because she's been asked to do something illegal. And then she finds out she's been asked to do it by the man who has prohibited it. And now here he is, prostrate on the ground, and she says, now look, I listened to you, and, so now you have to listen to me. You need to eat. Come on, eat! Eat something! Eat something! He's like, no, I don't want to eat! And he was probably so sick to his stomach he couldn't, but between her and his servants, she managed to put together a pretty nice meal for him, and he ate, and they went away. And to me, this is, I'm sorry for the spoilers. He's going to die before the end of the book. And so in a way, it's like the last meal of a condemned man. This is, I guess apart from his death, this is the final and most cruel abasement of Saul. And the message is very clear. If God tells you to do something, you probably ought to do it. Moving into chapter 19, we rush back to the camp of the Philistines at Aphek, and a battle is about to commence. And the commanders of, you remember, Philistia is kind of a loosely held collection of city-states. There are five of them, Gath being one of them. They're pretty independent, except when they want to fight somebody like Israel, then they all come together. Achish isn't like, Achish is kind of like the president, and these city-state commanders are like governors, okay? So he doesn't have any real control over them, apart from the fact that he's first among equals, I suppose we could say. And or prima inter pares, if you're into Latin, which I know a couple of you are. Show off. Michael's a show off. Anyway, it's like one of two Latin phrases I actually know. So they see these Hebrews, and that word's always important, because as you'll recall from our study of Exodus, Hebrews and Israelites oftentimes is used as something that overlaps completely, but that's not the case. You have the Israelites, and then there's a broader group of people, not of them, but affiliated with them. And these are just poor, oppressed, powerless people. So to call them Hebrews is an insult. Even though they know who David is, they know what David is capable of, they know what David has done. I mean, that's probably one of the reasons why King Achish accepted him into Philistia and gave him Ziklag in the first place. It's not sort of, oh, that's all water under the bridge kind of thing. He's thinking, oh, cool, David, excellent. I hear he's going to be the next king. So maybe he'll be a puppet king. Or at the very least, maybe we can be friends and not have to fight wars so often. Or maybe with him here, it will deprive Saul of so much strength that I can just wipe him out once and for all, and then poor David won't have a kingdom to have because it'll all be mine. And so, you know, Achish, in a way, I guess, was looking toward the opportunities for the future. But you're getting ready to fight, and the last thing you want is the enemy in your flank, much less in your ranks. And so they said, "Well, no. What's this guy and his crew doing here?" And the king's like, "Hey, he's all right. You know, he went to such and where and which and what and killed all these people and brought back camels and donkeys and candles from Yankee Candle Factory. And, you know, he's a good guy. He's a good guy." And they said, send him back, because we're not going to fight with this guy. He's been our enemy for a really long time. We have no idea what he might do in the heat of the battle. And the Israelites, they're masters of deceptions. It's entirely possible that he defected to us looking just for this opportunity to undermine us. You know, his people sing of him that he's killed in his tens of thousands, that little song verse that keeps popping up that so offended Saul and sort of began the split between Saul and David in the first place. And so, you know, Achish has to be practical. And, you know, it's David and 600 men, so it's not a decisive force. And he says, you've been a good guy. And I think they ought to let you fight. But, I'm going to have them let their way. And so you go ahead and go. And, you know, no sense making these guys mans. I mean, what difference is it going to make? There's always going to be another war. Maybe they'll change their minds by then. And David, this is great because he knows he can't go fight at the Israelites. He knows he can't do that. But he can't seem too eager to go home, because then people might think, see, we found him out. We found him out. He knows that we're on to him. So, you know, he's more than happy to go back to Ziklag. And he also doesn't want to seem like a coward either. He's like, okie dokie, that's great. I'll see you when you get back. Hope it all goes well. Best of luck. And so he said, I'm innocent. What have I done? I've been good, and I should be with you and be your bodyguard and help you defeat your enemies. And he says, yeah, I know. You're an angel, David, baby. I mean, I can see him smacking his cheek. You're like an angel to me. You're like, I know it's upsetting, but, you know, they don't want you to go. So, you know, just, you know, early in the morning, you're on back to Ziklag, and, you know, don't take this evil report to heart. I know you've been good, and, you know, I'll see you again. And so they do. They go back, and the Philistines go up to Jezreel to fight. And as we'll see, and we'll get back into 30, David may have wished that he'd actually been allowed to stay on the front lines and fight, because he's got a huge domestic mess waiting for him when he gets back, one that actually calls his authority into question. But that's pretty much what we've got going on in 27 through 29. Haven't gone over everything with a fine tooth comb. So any questions you got or stuff you're seeing, things you've learned in your own prep, just lay it out there.
To relate to today, the Philistines would be like Palestine.
Yeah, the Philistines...
Israel.
Yeah, the Philistines occupied territory roughly where... the Gaza Strip portion of the Palestinian Authority is. The borders aren't exact. I think, of course, the problem is the borders were constantly changing back in those days. I mean, sometimes Israel had pushed them back nearly into the sea, and sometimes when the Philistines were doing better, they held possession of, at that time, Israeli territory. So the extent of the territory each kingdom held differed, just back and forth. But yeah, that exact same area.
They're still fighting.
Yeah. Bad habits are hard to break, and each side has legitimate concerns and complaints against the other, but. There's a level at which where I wonder, when it comes to Israel and Palestine, because there are serious issues of justice and security there. I don't want to downplay that at all, but it almost reminds me of a unhappy married couple that argues all the time, and they can't even remember what they're arguing about. They're just arguing for the sake of argument. And sometimes I feel like it's just become a way of life for these folks to kill each other. You know, and I just wonder, you know, if you could satisfy the requirements of the Palestinians and the Israelis in terms of who gets what land and how's the security going to be worked out and citizenship and right of return, and if you found some magical way to work all of that out in Jerusalem besides, and so everybody's happy, they'd find a way to fight each other for something, for some reason, any reason anyway. So. Of course, we can't be judgmental or condemnatory because we always seem to find ways to pick our own fights. You know, if we don't have an enemy, we have to make one up. You know, when the Soviet Union ceased to be quite the threat it once was, then, oh my God, Grenada, Panama, you know. Can you imagine that we invaded Panama and Grenada? I mean, yeah, we had reasons. You always find reasons to invade somebody, especially when you spend a lot of good money on the military that's sitting around doing nothing. I mean, I know that sounds craven, but this is global politics, so. I mean, if you want to jump into 3031, we can do it. Have a clean break today. Okay. Yeah. I'm not. Correct. And I am sorry for having been sick last week. I would have much rather not been sick. But my pitiful immune system does send its apologies. And I'm not fully prepared for chapters 30 to 31, but it's not quite that complicated. And any questions I cannot respond to today, then I will answer next week. Yes, and Judy, I appreciate you doing that. In fact, if you can stick that in my box, I would love to take that home and watch it in my copious free time. Now, when David and his men came to Ziklag on the third day, the Amalekites had made a raid on the Negev and on Ziklag. They had attacked Ziklag, burned it down, and taken captive the women and all who were in it, both small and great. They killed none of them, but carried them off and went their way. When David and his men came to the city, they found it burned down, and their wives and sons and daughters taken captive. Then David and the people who were with him raised their voices and wept until they had no more strength to weep. David's two wives also had been taken captive, Ahinoam of Jezreel and Abigail, the widow of Nabal of Carmel. David was in great danger, for the people spoke of stoning him, because all the people were bitter in spirit for their sons and daughters. But David strengthened himself in the Lord his God. David said to the priest Abiathar, son of Ahimelech, "Bring me the ephod." So Abiathar brought the ephod to David. David inquired of the Lord, "Shall I pursue this band? Shall I overtake them?" He answered him, "Pursue, for you shall surely overtake and shall surely rescue." So David set out, he and 600 men who were with him. They came to the Wadi Besor, where those stayed who were left behind. But David went on with the pursuit. He and 400 men, 200 stayed behind, too exhausted to cross the Wadi Besor. In the open country they found an Egyptian and brought him to David. They gave him bread and he ate. They gave him water to drink. They also gave him a piece of fig cake and two clusters of raisins. When he had eaten, his spirit revived, for he had not eaten bread or drunk water for 3 days and three nights. Then David said to him, "To whom do you belong? Where are you from?" He said, "I am a young man of Egypt, servant to an Amalekite. My master left me behind because I fell sick 3 days ago. We had made a raid on the Negev of the Cherethites, and on that belongs to Judah, and on the Negev of Caleb, and we burned Ziklag down." David said to him, "Will you take me down to this raiding party?" He said, "Swear to me by God that you will not kill me or hand me over to my master, and I will take you down to them. When he had taken them down, they were spread out all over the ground, eating and drinking and dancing, because of the great amount of spoil they had taken from the land of the Philistines and from the land of Judah. David attacked them from twilight until the evening of the next day. Not one of them escaped except 400 young men who mounted camels and fled. David recovered all that the Amalekites had taken, and David rescued his two wives. Nothing was missing, whether small or great, sons or daughters, spoil or anything that had been taken. David brought back everything. David also captured all the flocks and herds which were driven ahead of the other cattle. People said, "This is David's spoil." Then David came to the 200 men who had been too exhausted to follow David and who had been left at the Wadi Bezor. They went out to meet David and to meet the people who were with him. When David drew near to the people, he saluted them. Then all the corrupt and worthless fellows among the men who had gone with David said, "Because they did not go with us, we will not give them any of the spoil that we have recovered, except that each man may take his wife and children and leave." But David said, "You shall not do so, my brothers, with what the Lord has given us. He has preserved us and handed over to us the raiding party that attacked us. Who would listen to you in this matter? For the share of the one who goes down into the battle shall be the same as the share of the one who stays by the baggage. They shall share alike." From that day forward, he made it a statute and an ordinance for Israel. It continues to the present day. When David came to Ziklag, he sent part of the spoil to his friends, the elders of Judah, saying, "Here's a present for you from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord." It was for those in Bethel, and Ramoth of the Negev, and Jatir, and Aror, and Sithmoth, and Eshtemoah, and Rechal, and the towns of the Jeremielites, and the towns of the Kenites, and Hormah, and Barashan, and Achah, and Hebron, and all the places where David and his men had roamed. Now the Philistines fought against Israel, and the men of Israel fled before the Philistines, and many fell on Mount Gilboa. The Philistines overtook Saul and his sons, and the Philistines killed Jonathan and Abinadab and Malchushia, the sons of Saul. The battle pressed hard upon Saul. The archers found him, and he was badly wounded by them. Then Saul said to his armor-bearer, "Draw your sword and thrust me through with it, so that these uncircumcised may not come and thrust me through and make sport of me." But his armor-bearer was unwilling, for he was terrified. So Saul took his own sword and fell upon it. When his armor-bearer saw that Saul was dead, he also fell upon his sword and died with him. So Saul and all his three sons and his armor-bearer and all his men died together on the same day. When the men of Israel who were on the other side of the valley and those beyond the Jordan saw that the men of Israel had fled and that Saul and his sons were dead, they forsook their towns and fled, and the Philistines came and occupied them. The next day, when the Philistines came to strip the dead, they found Saul and his three sons fallen on Mount Gilboa. They cut off his head, stripped off his armor, and sent messengers throughout the land of the Philistines to carry the good news to the houses of their idols and to the people. They put his armor in the temple of Astarte, and they fastened his body to the wall of Beth Shan. But when the inhabitants of Jabesh Gilead heard what the Philistines had done to Saul, all the valiant men set out, traveled all night long, and took the body of Saul and the bodies of his sons from the wall of Beth Shan. They came to Jabesh and burned them there. Then they took their bones and buried them under the tamarisk tree in Jabesh and fasted 7 days. The word of the Lord.
Thank you.
Okay, I gotta get another glass of water, sorry.
So, when David gets back to Ziklag, some of the people that he'd been raiding returned the favor, but not quite in the same way. Instead of killing all the people, they actually took them captive, possibly for ransom or from negotiating leverage to extract some sort of contract or something with David that he wouldn't attack them again. And he gets there, and the whole city's been burned down, and you know, David and the people are crying their eyes out, and you know, because his wives are gone too. And then in verse 6 it says, David was in great danger, for the people spoke of stoning him.
Now, of course, these aren't Israelites who have been singing his praises and gradually gravitating toward him and supporting him. These are Philistines. He'd only been with them around 16 months, but they had profited well by his leadership. But he's in a bad situation, and so David goes to Abiathar, the priest, and says, "I need the ephod." And how instructive, the contrast. You know, David consults God using the stones, the Urim and the Thummim, and God answers him. He wouldn't even answer Saul. You know, he wouldn't even give Saul the courtesy of I really don't like you anymore. In fact, I hate you, so you and your sons are going to die, and Israel's going to be defeated. I mean, you know, and God says, "Oh, yeah, absolutely, you should go after them." And it's interesting that David hesitates, because he's a man of action, or has become one after a period of passivity during the sort of early phases of the conspiracy to elevate him above Saul. And he says, "Oh, yeah, go for him." So he takes 600 men, he gets 200, they kind of get tired, so they stay at the Wadi Besor, and the 400 go on. And they find this Egyptian out in the country, and they feed him, give him some of the drink. He had not had anything for 3 days. And in exchange, David wanted information. "Where are you from? Who are you connected to?" Dangerous types of questions to answer in that part of the world, especially at this time. "Well, I'm an Egyptian. I serve an Amalekite." Whoops. So apparently David didn't kill all the Amalekites. "I got sick, so my last master left me behind. So I'm more than happy to tell you anything you want to know, because my master's a jerk. And we did these raids on Judah and neighbors and allies of Judah, as well as Ziklag. That's what the Cherethites and the Negev of Caleb are all about." And he says, "Well, could you take me to where they are?" And he says, "Well, as long as you won't kill me or tell my master what I did, yeah, sure, no problem." So he went down there, and they're enjoying the spoils of victory, and no army's more vulnerable than, after a victorious battle. And so, in an overnight attack through the next day, 24-hour attack, his men attacked, all 400 of them, and only 400 of the raiders escaped. He got everything back that had been taken, including his wives. Then he began to make his way back home. And people who at one point were thinking of stoning him because he was responsible for their well-being, for their safety, and he had failed. Despite the fact that he failed for a good reason, he was with the king getting ready to give battle to the hated Israelites. So he's vindicated here. Now this belongs to him, because we like him again now, because he made it all better. And he comes to the 200 who are at the Wadi Besor, and the guys who had fought with him said they shouldn't get anything. I mean, they can have their wives back and their kids, that's all right. But nothing else. They shouldn't get anything else, because they stayed back here and didn't fight. And David said, no, it doesn't work like that. They stayed behind with the baggage train. They had our rear. They were our reserve. So they get a share. We all share alike. Very egalitarian. And it says in verse 25 of chapter 30 that became an ordinance for Israel, continued to the present day. We don't actually know if that's the case or not, but that's what the story tells us. He gets back to Ziklag, and he distributes the spoils identifies it as a present from the spoil of the enemies of the Lord. And it specifies where the people lived that he gave all this stuff to. And including some of the places that he himself had attacked. So it's kind of interesting. And then you get into 31, and we're back to the final battle between the Philistines and Israel, for 1 Samuel at least. And they get routed, completely routed. And Saul has gotten hit by some arrows. He knows he's going to die. He doesn't want to be captured by the Philistines. He doesn't want to be killed by a Philistine. And so he tries to get his armor bearer, his right-hand man, to thrust him through, and he just can't bring himself to do it. And so Saul falls on his own sword. And And then his armor-bearer followed Saul's example. His three sons died in the battle in a more, I guess, sort of honorable and glorious way. And so the Philistines just whipped him. And then they came and they found Saul's body, and they chopped his head off, took his armor as a prize, they put his armor in the temple of Astarte, one of many gods the Philistines worshipped, and then they tacked his body up to the wall of a city, which even by the standards of the day, that's pretty tacky. But, you know, the writer may intend for the reader to see in this, you know, extreme humiliation, the degree to which Saul had become, as Samuel said, an enemy of God, and there are consequences for that. Some people in Jabesh Gilead, you know, said, no, this isn't going to do. So they snuck out at night, grabbed his body, got him down. It doesn't specify earlier, but apparently the bodies of his three sons also were tacked up to the wall of Bethshan. It's nasty. Yeah, it was pretty rough, and they buried them and fasted. That's the end of the story so far until we get into 2 Samuel.
I have two definitions here. It says, according to some parts of the tradition, Saul came to a noble but tragic end, defending his people and land all his ability.
Yeah.
Probably, however, he was utterly unworthy. Entirely deserving of unhappy fate.
Yeah, I'd agree with the second batch of scholars that are.
Later writers, in order to glorify David, felt it necessary to depreciate Saul.
Yeah, I mean, it's what you wrestle with in Samuel is there are two strains of tradition, one that thinks that the kingship is, on the whole, a good idea, and another that thinks the kingship is a bad idea. You have partisans of Saul and partisans of David. And you have people who's like, well, kingship really wasn't a good idea except when it was David and Solomon's turn. And apart from that, it was a really bad idea. And that's kind of a prophetic perspective. And so, you know, it's really nice because the people who have provided us with the texts which have been assembled and translated into the text that we have, mm-hmm. chose to include both viewpoints. Mm-hmm. I mean, how marvelous it is that in terms of something of such central importance to the identity of a nation, that for all time, multiple viewpoints would be allowed to endure. And so, as barbaric as our ancestors could be in battle, in the punishments they meted out to criminals, and the way they treated women and children and old slaves and things like that, I think we have to honor, you know, the inspiration of God in leading them to find a way to try to harmonize their viewpoints, which were diametrically opposed. I mean, you either think having a king is a good idea or you don't. There's not a whole lot of in between. Unless you want to, you know, include a little fudge factor there, but
excuse me.
Yeah.
And then one more statement. It said David himself may have had no such attitude to deprecate Saul.
Well, I mean, yeah. Victors write history, and David definitely was victorious over Saul. Even before Saul died, he was victorious over Saul. Even before David became king. I mean, he was the winner. These books are trying to explain to us what Yahweh's doing and how and why in terms of the kingship. Okay? And David in particular, being the greatest king Israel ever knew, it takes a lot of explaining. How did he get to become king in the first place? Because Saul came before him. And how did he succeed Saul? You know, and there are these stories that Saul tried to kill him. What's going on with Saul? What does that mean? And, you know, we've heard tell that, you know, David, trying to get away from Saul, actually hung out with the Philistines for 16 months. What's going on with that? You know, and, you know, and some people, Saul partisans, you know, the bitter enders, you know, their perspective could have been, had David not run away to the Philistines and stayed here with us and found a way to make up with Saul and fought with us, the Philistines wouldn't have whipped us the way they did in chapter 31. You know, and so you've got a lot of different vantage points on these events, and who's responsible for what, and how's God operating in the midst of all of it. But on balance, the majority report is that, and this is sort of a summation of 1 Samuel in a way as a whole, God didn't like the idea of Israel having any other king than him. But through the prophet Samuel, he had him select Saul. It was an ill-fated choice, and perhaps a purposefully one, purposefully made one. Saul gained God's enmity by refusing to obey, but is it possible that God knew that Saul was a deeply flawed choice for the first king, so that an even greater king could be risen after him? So you start off with a negative example. This is what a king shouldn't be. And I told you it was going to be bad. And then you get David, not a member of Saul's royal line. Okay? Yeah, Judy, you had something, and then I'll go to Jen.
I'm just thinking that all along, the text is showing God in charge of everything. And it's written to show that. And so Saul, at the very end, is taking matters in his own hands. He was not relying on God.
He tried, but God wouldn't answer him.
When he had no other choice, it was too late. David, on the other hand, even in his darkest moments, always turned to God. David is a brutal man. He's flawed too. But
we're not shown this right now in the story.
No.
I mean, right now Uriah the Hittite has no clue what's coming his way. So,
but in any case, you know, the text still shows God in charge.
It does.
God is in charge, and that's the whole history of these Jewish people and us Christians who follow them. This is our whole history.
Yeah.
And as you say, the victors write history. Mm-hmm. Okay. This is. All of the texts that we write show God as being the source of life and in charge. He may not cause things to happen, even though this says it does.
Well, we get to make bad choices, yeah, or good ones.
He uses those choices that these people make for his purposes.
Well, yeah, I mean, well, God's going to respond to whatever you do. And, you know, Saul made bad choices, disobeyed God. And so Yahweh basically decides to find a replacement, to choose one whom will win over Saul's own children, the people, the prophets, the priesthood. David did obey. David did rely on God, and therefore God magnified and exalted him. Had David made choices more similar to Saul's, then the same fate would have befell David. So God responds to the choices people make, sometimes with mercy, sometimes with severity. This high-stakes situation where this 12 tribal amphictyony, a confederacy, was being consolidated under a king, despite the fact that's not what God wanted. They had enemies on every side, eager to destroy them. Mistakes could not be tolerated from people in the highest reaches of authority, and it wasn't tolerated by God, because only obedience to God could preserve the people, especially in this ill-thought-out transition to monarchy.
any validation of any war. But things have not changed. And you see on the news every day, you know, you're reading this in the slaughters of everybody, men, women, and children. Look what's happening in Syria right now. We're seeing on the news every night these two little girls out of the
Mojave. Oh, yeah.
And the towns are wiped out. I mean, it's the same thing. It's the same damn thing, and it just makes me furious. And I can't see God in any of it.
Well, I don't think God is pleased. I mean, one of the difficulties of the Old Testament is that everyone in the ancient world believed that if you fought and won, it's because God liked you and made you win. Okay? I mean, that's one of the reasons why early Christians were persecuted. They wouldn't sacrifice to the pagan gods. And so if something bad happened, like there was a famine or a plague or they lost an important battle, why are the gods angry at us? Well, you need a scapegoat. You know, the gods are angry because these Christian people, these Jesus followers, won't sacrifice to them. That's why they're mad. So we got to get them sacrificing bulls to Athena and Apollo and Jupiter. And, you know, that way we won't have another famine or plague. We'll win the next battle and not lose it. And there are many people today who feel the exact same way. You know, God takes sides in war, and every side thinks that God's taking their side. And of course, when you win, you get to be the one that says, "No, God liked me better." You know, so but then you begin to look at the grim realities of wars, and you have to ask yourself, "Has God forsaken these small children and these women who are starving and being killed and maimed and have inadequate medical treatment? They have no way out, completely surrounded in Syria and so many other places throughout the world. I mean, the Congo's probably going to blow up before the summer comes again in a way that it has in ages. And, you know, and you remember when the Rwandan massacre, the 600,000, you know, everybody knew about that because of how gruesome it was, because most of the killing was done with machetes. Millions, we don't know how many, we think between 2 to 4 million people died in the last Congolese war. How many of you had any idea that there had been a major war in the Congo and that it was hotting up again on us? You see, and the only reason I know is because I take a magazine called The Economist every week, and it had a half-page article on it, you know, explaining, you know, it's looking like, you know, there's going to be another civil war, and Rwanda and Uganda and Kenya and all the neighbors are going to pile back in again. It's going to be one of these god-awful nightmares. You know, and I could have skipped that page easily. So it's challenging. I mean, for me, the most challenging book in the entire Bible is Joshua. And that's the book where it comes right after the Torah, right after Deuteronomy. Moses has died, and his successor, Joshua, leads the people into the Promised Land and kills everybody at God's command. And a couple of times they don't, God gets PO'd. And, you know, and so it's not just the God who leads a people to victory over others by killing them, or leads them to defeat because he's angry and allows other people to kill his own people. It's that God sets black flag terms. You know, run up the skull and crossbone, boys, because we're not taking any prisoners. None. And the non-combatants, they're dying too. And this is an area where, theologically, I believe that God has not changed in that respect over the past 3,000 or so years, but that people's interpretation of the historical events and God's role in them, I think they were mistaken. I just think they were mistaken. You know,
so
I mean,
are you saying kind of what I was trying to say about saying that the people who wrote these texts are intent on showing God the source of all things?
the source of life,
yes,
the source of all things.
And in order
and
to do that,
in order, and what I'm saying, my interpretation then is, he didn't cause the bad things to happen, but he used the things. He used the bad choices that people made. That's kind of my interpretation,
yeah,
that he wasn't the source of those bad decisions.
Yeah.
The humans themselves were.
Yeah.
But that he took their bad. I mean, look at the cross.
Yeah. I mean, this is the attitude that it was that this is what happened, so it must have been God's will, because if anything, because anything major that happens has to happen because of God's will. When you get your butt beat, or when you indiscriminately slaughter men, women, and children, this may seem cynical or too critical, but it's awfully easy to say, well, we got whipped, or we killed all those children because God wanted it that way. You know, I mean, isn't that a great out? You know, I left my wife for one of my graduate students because God wanted it that way. I'm happier now, so obviously God wanted it that way. And my ex-wife was a mean little so-and-so, so she got what she deserved too. Justice prevails. God wins. Hooray! You know, I mean, you can do that with practically anything, and we do. And we do. Not in a sort of grotesque manner that we see sometimes, but in ways big and small. And so we do have to be cautious, because we want God's will to be done, but the fact of the matter is God's will often is not done. What's happening to these children in Syria is in no way, shape, or form identifiable to me with God's will. And, you know, because if it must accord with God's will, then I have a massive theological problem. I can't worship a God who wants those Syrian children to suffer like that. I can't. I cannot and will not worship a God like that. You know, and so maybe I'm too clever by half and I'm doing a workaround, but when I read Joshua, which is only when I absolutely must, you know, what I tell myself is, this is revelatory of God, but in a very slanted and poisoned sort of way. Because if I have to take it literally as an errant scripture, you know, and, you know, God's orders were kill them all, just to get them out of the way, make sure they don't cause any trouble down the line, that's not a God I can worship. Sorry. Okay, let's say a quick prayer and off we go. God, we give you thanks that you have led us through this book, and we're grateful for all of those people who are in it, even the bad ones, because through them your story was told. We give you thanks for the people who wrote these things down and preserved them orally generation after generation, and for those who took these records and at a point in time decided to assemble them and form them in a way that would speak the truth as best as your inspiration could give them to share. We ask that you continually be with us as we strive to interpret our scripture that you've so graciously given us. Help us to learn lessons from it that apply to our daily lives, not just our personal lives, but to the wider world around us. We ask as we continue our adventure into 2 Samuel, you'll continue to sustain us with your strength. And all this we ask in the name of Jesus Christ our Lord. Amen.
Amen.
All right. Thanks, everybody. Oh, it's my pleasure. So the tables can just be shoved up against the wall. We don't have to unfold those and put those away. Somebody got in here and got a little over enthusiastic on us with that. So.